Support for WMFE comes from Orlando Science Center, offering four floors of wonder and discovery for families and curious minds of all ages, with exhibits, movies, and live shows that promote learning new skills, exploring fresh ideas, and cultivating a better understanding of the world around us. Tickets and more at osc.org.
The early days of SpaceX and the long road to success. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. From booster landings to astronaut launches, it's hard to imagine a time when SpaceX struggled. But once, it seemed like the company may never get off the ground. Eric Berger, journalist and Ars Technica's senior space editor, chronicles the company's desperate first years in his new book, Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. Starting with SpaceX's founding in 2002 and ending with the successful launch of Falcon 1 in 2008. Berger spoke with some of the earliest employees at SpaceX, along with the ringmaster of SpaceX, founder and chief engineer Elon Musk, revealing the first public glimpse of how the company almost never was, and how the gritty, determined, and sometimes even reckless engineers gave it their all to get SpaceX's first orbital rocket, Falcon 1, off the launch pad. We'll talk to Berger about his reporting and how the early struggles and triumphs of SpaceX are ingrained in the company's DNA. But first, a conversation with Shane Kimbrough, NASA astronaut and commander of SpaceX's Crew 2 mission, about training to launch on the Dragon. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. Next month, a crew of four will ride into orbit on SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule, launching on a six-month mission to the International Space Station. It will be the second operational flight of the SpaceX Dragon spacecraft under NASA's Commercial Crew Program. Shane Kimbrough will command that Crew Dragon flight. He's flown to space on the Space Shuttle and Russian Soyuz capsule, making this his third spacecraft. His mission launches in late April from Kennedy Space Center. He joins us now from the Johnson Space Center in Texas. Shane, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
You know, being an audio guy here working in radio, it's my understanding that SpaceX has recorded some audio from inside the Dragon. I'm wondering if you've heard that yet and how that kind of plays into your training for your mission.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't get all those transcripts, unfortunately, because that would be really, really neat for us. But throughout our training, they have the trainers have input those kind of tidbits in a class or two. Hey, here's some audio you may want to hear during this phase of flight. So it has been integrated nicely. We probably don't need all of it either. So they've done a nice job, I think, of getting the things that they think we really need to hear and just kind of interjecting that along the training flow.
With a new vehicle like this, I mean, is that kind of helpful, kind of putting your mind at ease as to what you're going to experience during this flight?
It certainly helps just to kind of get you into the right mindset for, you know, especially the launch, you know, very dynamic ascent phase of flight. So it's been helpful to hear those things there. But, you know, just the training in general does that as well. So it just gets us, the more we do it, the more comfortable we are with the vehicle, with the training team, with the mission control teams, and with our crew.
You've flown on both Shuttle and Soyuz. Aside from the lack of buttons, what's been the biggest difference in the training protocol for Crew Dragon?
Biggest difference probably is just, I mean, it is a clean vehicle like you're alluding to. It's small in a way. It's bigger than Soyuz, of course, but it's small in that it's, you kind of know where everything is. Shuttle was much more grand, I think, in that regard. But it's been really great through the training flow, obviously, to get familiar with it. For me, having been to station, I wasn't super concerned about the station training. Mm-hmm. For me, I really had to dig into the SpaceX Crew Dragon training because that was all new to me and new to the whole crew. But I got assigned about 4 or 5 months later than the rest of the crew, so I had some catching up to do. I think we're there now. We're really ready to go.
With Crew 2, you're going to be returning to Florida to launch for this mission. Can you reflect on what it's like to launch from Florida Space Coast? And what's the significance of coming back to the U.S. once again?
Yeah, I'm very excited. I hope our whole nation is really excited that we have the launch capability now that we didn't have for about a decade. We had a great partner with the Russians and that they, you know, we got to fly with them and got to continue going to the International Space Station. But for me personally, it's really a thrill to get back to the Space Coast and to be launching out of the Kennedy Space Center. I grew up a few years of my young age down just across the river in Mims, Florida, just north of Titusville there. And that's where my grandparents are from. So I have a lot of fond memories personally of that area and looking forward to bringing some more excitement back to the Space Coast.
How much time have you spent with Endeavour, and are you calling it Endeavour 2.0 or Endeavour Junior, since that was your previous shuttle? How much time have you spent with it, and what's been the process like?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to be part of the team that recovered this vehicle when Bob and Doug flew on it back in May and recovered it in August. And so I got to see it come out of the water, knowing at that time that I was assigned to this mission. So that's probably the last time I saw it. We're going to get a chance to see it here in about 2 weeks when we go down to do our crew equipment interface test, where we get to actually get in the capsule and put the thing through the ringer and push all the buttons and do everything we need. So that'll be, we don't get to interact with it very often to answer your question. And we're really looking forward to the chance, the one chance we have before launch, to get in the vehicle here in a couple weeks.
And are you going to nickname it something to differentiate it from Shuttle Endeavour?
No, I like Endeavour. It's great. For me, it's obviously very easy to have the same call sign. It's a good problem to have, I guess.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Shane. Best of luck, and can't wait to see you fly.
Thanks, Brendan. Appreciate your time.
Kimbrough and his crew are launching on SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule, getting a ride to space on the company's Falcon 9 rocket. The past few years for SpaceX have been fruitful, from the near mastery of rocket booster recovery to successful human missions. But the early days of SpaceX were defined by engineering challenges, funding struggles, and rocket mishaps. Ars Technica's senior space editor Eric Berger has kept a keen reporter's eye on SpaceX's development, and his new book, Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX, chronicles the early days of SpaceX that defined the company today. Eric Berger, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, hi, Brennan. It's nice to talk to you.
Eric, with all the SpaceX successes in recent days, I'm thinking from, the mastery of booster landings to recent astronaut launches, it's hard to imagine a time when the company struggled. Take us back to those desperate early days of SpaceX. What was it like?
When Elon Musk founded SpaceX in 2002, he was trying to do something that no private company had ever done before. And there were a long list of other rich people with high profiles or rocket scientists with good ideas who had tried to do exactly what he set out to do with a liquid-fueled rocket to orbit and lowering the cost of, launching commercial satellites to space. And the fact of the matter is they overcame three launch failures. So the first rocket failed in March of 2006. Another one failed a year later. And then another one failed again a little more than a year later. And by then he was out of money. They had the parts for one more rocket in their factory, and they had a matter of weeks before they ran out of money, and they had to get that last rocket to orbit in September of 2008. So, it's the story of a company that, although it was founded by a multimillionaire in Musk, still had limited resources, and it faced a lot of hurdles that companies today don't, in the sense that, there were no private companies launching liquid fueled orbital rockets back then. And so industry didn't know how to really treat them. The military didn't know how to treat them on their launch ranges. NASA was wary of them. And so it was really pretty desperate, as you say, in trying to overcome those first three failures.
In the book, the case is made that SpaceX's early success was fueled by that early talent that joined the company. These are these scrappy engineers that, built and developed things at Musk's rapid pace. And you chronicle some of the hiring in the book where, Elon had a hand in most, if not all, of these hires. I mean, what do we know about how he recognized this talent and how he motivated them to move at this unprecedented pace to do things that no private company had ever done before?
Yeah, I think one of the hidden talents of Elon and really the secrets of the success that SpaceX had was the fact that he was really good at both identifying smart and motivated young people, engineers, who had a bit of an entrepreneurial bent. And he was also able to know who among them would be willing to give their all for SpaceX. So the company has a demanding work environment today, but back in the early 2000s, it was an insane work environment. It was longer than 80-hour work weeks. A lot of people told me they would frequently sleep under their desk, or catch a few hours of sleep on the factory floor as they kept to these schedules. And Musk had a lot to offer them, right? He did push them incredibly hard. He's demanding. When things go wrong, he can be a real jerk, right? But he also provided them with resources. And he set these really outlandish goals. You know, from the beginning, they were working towards sending humans to Mars way back in 2002. And he allowed them to go fast. You know, one of the people who I spoke to was Phil Kassouf, who hadn't even finished college when he hired on at SpaceX. And he told me he was, you know, building circuit boards for the upper stage, trying to manage range issues, you know, working structures. You know, he said there were so many hats we wore, we couldn't keep track of them. He had gone to USC and he talked to a friend of his who worked in the F-35 program. And his friend, you know, had a comfortable job, a good life, a big house, family. But his whole sole professional responsibility was making sure that a single bolt on the landing gear for the F-35 was procured, you know, and correct. And that was like the totality of his professional existence. And so SpaceX was a really rich environment and certain engineers could thrive in it and certain of them washed out. It was Musk's ability to find those people who would thrive and then motivate them. And you're right. He was involved with the hiring of the first 3,000 engineers at the company. Like he interviewed every one of them because he felt like he had to get the right kind of people at the company.
Eric, you've had the opportunity to interview Musk multiple times for this book. You've talked to these early staffers at SpaceX. What do you see in Elon and what do these staffers see in Elon?
Elon is a larger than life personality, and he has this rare drive that never turns off. He is constantly focused on whatever it is, the task at hand. And typically he likes to take on the most challenging engineering problems first and solve those and then move on to the easier ones. And so he sort of pushes that, has that drive pushing him forward. And the thing that's really unique about him is that there is this constant pressure to move forward as rapidly as possible. And so he's always asking his people to do things faster than they might expect. One of the things I say in the book is he tries to make the impossible possible in terms of timelines, in terms of hardware goals and things like that. And that's what, you know, there's this meme now of Elon time. And that's because he sort of always says, well, we're going to try to do this with the Starship program or this with the Falcon 9 program by such and such a date, and never happens. And that's because like those dates that he says, those are the internal goals that he's setting for those programs to happen. Like way back in September 28, 2019, when they did the first Starship reveal event in South Texas, you know, I was at the factory 2 weeks before that, and they had not fabricated large pieces of that vehicle yet. He had like a literally hour by hour schedule of hardware that needed to be done and shipped to Texas and assembled to be ready for that event. And it's just like that never stops. It's like that kind of intensity in the company all the time. And so, you know, that burns people out. And so a lot of the early employees at SpaceX lasted, you know, half a decade or a decade, and a lot of them are gone now. Some are still there. Like Hans Konigsmann is still in an advisory role. Florence Lee in the book is still there. And Gwen Shotwell, of course, is still at the company. But a lot of the other people I talked to, like the launch director, Tim Buzza, some of the founding employees of Chris Thompson and Tom Mueller have left for a number of years because it just was such a rewarding but challenging environment.
There's some harrowing moments you chronicle in the book, like, I won't give too much away, but an engineer diving into a Falcon booster while in the belly of a C-17 plane. There's this constant fear of running out of cash. And you reminded me while I was reading this book, this was all happening during the Great Recession when venture capital was all but dried out. I mean, how close was SpaceX coming to failure in these early days?
Yeah, they were close on at least three different occasions. The first one is you referenced, they had the first stage for their fourth launch. So this is the one that had to go. They only had weeks to launch it in September of 2008. And so to make their schedule for the first time, instead of shipping the first stage by boat, they were able to procure a C-17 transport for about $500,000 from the Department of Defense. And some of the engineers from SpaceX, to save money, actually rode along in this airplane from the factory in Southern California to the launch site in Kwajalein, which if you imagine flying to Hawaii and then flying that distance again into the Pacific is how far Kwajalein is from the United States. And as they were descending into Honolulu, the first leg of this journey, they hadn't got the pressures quite right. And so the first stage started imploding. And very quickly, they needed to, you know, release the pressure on the interior of this rocket, or it would have imploded and crumpled. And this was their very last hardware. They had nothing else. The company was doomed. And so an engineer named Zach Dunn, who has a wonderful story, and I talk a lot about him in the book, just this marvelous enthusiasm for rocketry. He was the guy who was responsible for the first stage propulsion system. And so at 35,000 feet, as this rocket is imploding, you know, all hell is breaking loose in the payload area of the C-17. He crawls in there into the dark to try to find this valve and open it and release it. And so that's one. The second failure point was if that rocket ultimately hadn't launched a few weeks later successfully, they would have failed. And then finally, they would have failed at the end of 2008 if they hadn't got this large amount of money from NASA to develop the commercial resupply missions that ultimately led to the Cargo Dragon supply missions to the space station.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eric Berger. He's a journalist and author of the new book, Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. Our conversation about these early days and how the company's early struggles are driving the current development of SpaceX's Starship continues after the break. Are We There Yet? Is back in a minute. You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're talking with journalist and author Eric Berger about his new book, Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. The book focuses on the development and launch of Falcon 1, which is SpaceX's first orbital rocket. It had two successful missions into orbit before SpaceX moved on to Falcon 9, kind of abruptly, as it's written in the book. How much of the Falcon 1 development went into the more familiar Falcon 9 system that we're used to seeing today?
Yeah, they dropped the Falcon 1 pretty quickly after they got the development contract from NASA for the Falcon 9. I think it was two reasons. One, there wasn't that much of a market at the time for dedicated small satellite launches. And two, Elon was always thinking bigger. And so when the opportunity to build a bigger rocket came along, he seized it. Now, they learned a lot of enormously valuable lessons from the Falcon 1. Most notably, they got the Merlin 1C rocket engine developed. So they went through a couple of iterations of that and ended up with a pretty good engine that was shipped right over from the Falcon 1 and put into the Falcon 9, where there were nine of them. And the engineers, Tom Muller, Tim Buzz, other people told me that based upon all of their challenges, and they had many challenges with the Merlin engine, that when they finally got it to the Falcon 9, it was a pretty mature. And so they had the most important part of the rocket ready to go. It was a matter of sort of figuring out how to integrate nine of them together and build a bigger version of the Falcon 1 and the Falcon to make the Falcon 9. So they had gone through a lot of growing pains. You know, they spent 6 years going from the beginning of the company to launching the Falcon one into orbit. They spent about 3 years on the Falcon 9 program in terms of getting it to orbit. So they really were able to compress that time.
Reading about these early days of SpaceX, Eric, I can't help but draw the parallels to the development of Starship happening in Texas. I know you spent quite a bit of time out there watching that hardware come together. How much of that early DNA of SpaceX and the Falcon 1 is at play in Boca Chica and the development of Starship?
It's definitely ingrained in the company. Elon set the tone for SpaceX early on. His first vice presidents picked that up and ran with it, and it just sort of spread through the company. And so that Falcon 1 DNA, as you say, is very much at play in South Texas with the Starship program. And there are other parallels as well. You know, they're able to move as fast as they possibly can. Well, almost as fast when the FAA is not saying, "Hey, wait a minute." But when they were working on Kwajalein, you know, they were dealing with the Army restrictions on the range there, and the Army was pretty permissive, and they basically had carte blanche on Omelek Island, where they were launching from in that atoll, to do what they wanted. And it's similar in South Texas. They can iterate and test and go almost as fast at the speed that they want to go. So that similarity. The difference is back in the Falcon 1 days, it was literally a few dozen engineers designing, building, and scrounging together this hardware. So they were all doing many, many jobs in trying to make this rocket go. And now with the Starship program, you know, if Elon needs to hire 200 welders in a weekend, he can hire 200 welders in a weekend. Or if he needs to bring dozens of engineers into Boca Chica, you know, he can have a hiring fair and make that happen. So the resources now are, you know, that's why you see them building six Starships at a time in Boca Chica, because all of a sudden Elon Musk isn't a struggling millionaire. He's, you know, kind of this global celebrity, one of the richest people in the world. And so he can really make things happen with much greater resources on a much bigger scale.
In the end, SpaceX accomplished what it set out to do, lower the cost of access to space. You know, where the industry once scoffed at some of their ideas, aerospace players are now rushing to catch up with this. I'm wondering though, Eric, what happens if SpaceX didn't succeed? I mean, what kind of world would we live in if that RATSAT flight didn't make it to orbit? What would the aerospace industry look like today without SpaceX?
I think, first of all, it would be a lot more boring, because for whatever you think about Elon Musk, maybe you don't like some of the controversial things he says on Twitter, or maybe you think he's, you know, this world-changing, awesome bro, right? He is interesting, and he shakes things up, and he is forever sort of pushing NASA and everyone else to go faster and further. I think what SpaceX really has been is a forcing function across the industry. It's forced ULA to try to be more nimble and move more quickly. And because they were successful 12 years ago with the Falcon 1, and then sort of we've seen what's happened over the last decade, a number of other companies have found it much easier to go out and get capital that they need from the private markets to do small launch, or to do orbital manufacturing, or to do small space stations. It's really sort of laid a foundation for other companies to go to the private capital markets and say, hey, look, we can become the next SpaceX because our technology XYZ, that kind of thing. So they've made it more dynamic, more interesting. You know, I think a counterweight to that would be, you know, look at what's happened to Blue Origin. This is another company founded by someone who's very wealthy, Jeff Bezos, and similar goals. Like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos have both looked at sort of what it would take to get lots of humans living and working in space, and said, well, the first step is low cost, reusable launch. And so they both developed big rockets that, you know, land offshore, Falcon Heavy and Starship for SpaceX, and New Glenn for Blue Origin. But, you know, look back at, I like to look back to the end of 2015 for that question, Brendan, because that was the time when Blue Origin landed New Shepard for the first time in West Texas successfully. And then a few months later, SpaceX landed the Falcon 9 for the first time successfully along the coast of Florida. You know, that's a little more than 5 years ago now. So over that time, Blue Origin has kind of acted like a traditional space company. They've gone out, they tried to win some contracts, they've spent that time working on New Glenn, they've flown New Shepard about a dozen times, right? And then they're working on a human landing system. In those 5 years, SpaceX has launched nearly 100 orbital rockets. They've made enormous strides in reuse, having flown some of their rockets as much as 8 times. They've become the world's largest satellite operator. They've developed a second generation cargo Dragon. They've developed a Crew Dragon that can take people to space. They've developed the Falcon Heavy rocket. They've made big progress in the Starship program, having flown that vehicle on test flights almost half a dozen times. I mean, so, and this is not to denigrate Blue Origin. This is just to show how dynamic SpaceX has been over the last decade, and now how we in the space community look at it and say, well, you know, what was happening with the space shuttle program, or maybe the space launch system, like that's how it had always been done. And we could look back and marvel at these big vehicles doing great things for NASA, but damn it, those programs were really slow and they were really expensive. And now SpaceX has shown another way. And I think it's caused the rest of the industry to really try to step up its game. And so it's been really healthy, I think.
Finally, Eric, you've been covering space for quite some time. And with this book, you've had some unprecedented access to these early staff members and conversations with Elon Musk. I'm wondering if there's anything from reporting this book out or writing this book that stuck with you or surprised you from someone who has been following this for as long as you have.
You know, I think what did ultimately surprise me the most is the role that Elon actually played in SpaceX. Because you're always wondering with these companies, you know, is this person just the visionary? Is this person just writing the checks? You know, how integral are they to the success of their company? And this is not to lionize Elon Musk, but the fact of the matter is, you know, you go back and talk to the earliest people who worked for him, you know, he was in most of those engineering meetings. He was the one who was helping to make the most difficult calls. Like the buck literally stopped with him. You know, when the second rocket failed, this was in March of 2007, second flight of the Falcon 1 rocket. It was due to a problem with, you know, fluid moving around in the upper stage and causing it to spin out of control. And that problem had come to Elon as one of the risks for the flight, and he'd signed off on it, this slosh problem. And so he got very angry after the first flight because of a propulsion problem. But after the second flight, it was something he had, you know, he had seen the data and signed off on it. And so he didn't, you know, there was much less of a backlash. Like it was put your heads down, let's get to work and sort of, you know, figure this problem out. So like, you know, from just, you know, providing the vision and funding, yes, he did that, but he also was helping to make the hardest engineering decisions. And, you know, he was there every day making the key hires and finding ways to motivate his people and move them forward. And so, you know, the success of SpaceX is due to the people he hired, but it's also just due to deep involvement by Elon at every step of the way. And one of the things I try to do with Liftoff is really show examples in which, you know, in which that was the case, that he provided this pressure to keep them moving forward and ultimately succeed.
It really is an intimate and inspiring recap of those early days of SpaceX. The book is Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. It's out this week. We've been speaking by the book's author and senior space editor at Ars Technica, Eric Berger. Eric, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Brendan. Thank you very much.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Be sure to follow Eric on Twitter. He's at SciGuySpace, and look for his book, Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX, wherever you purchase your books these days. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed and never miss an episode. You can do that on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Are We There Yet? It's a production of WMFE, America's Space Station. Editorial guidance this week from Matthew Petty. Our intern is Kirk Churchill. Our director of content is Steve Yasko. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.